Hello and welcome to the China Business, a podcast by the China Booking Business Council, where we explain the latest news relevant to anyone working in or with the world's second largest economy. I'm Joe Cash, and I'm delighted to be joined for today's episode by Sir Sherrod Cooper-Coles, who is the chair of the China Booking Business Council, an experienced diplomat having previously served as ambassador to Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia and Israel, and now one of the leading voices in the ongoing debate surrounding the UK's economic relationship with China. Sir Sherrod, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Joe.
So, if I may, I'd like to begin today's interview by asking you a few personal questions about your time as a diplomat, expanding that to consider the role that business is having to play in UK-China relations, growing that conversation into where is the UK taking its economic relationship with China now that it's left the European Union? With all that in mind, my first question would be, why, after a distinguished career in the Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office, predominantly focused on the Middle East and being an Arabist yourself, did you decide to turn your attention back towards China? You were the head of the Hong Kong department at the FCDO from 1994 to 97, speechwriter to former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher from 1983 to 1987, during which the negotiations over Hong Kong took place. What brought you back to China?
Well, Joe, I was always interested in China since I was a schoolboy. I did Greek and Latin for A-level, but there was an option at my school to study China. And we had a very enlightened history master who taught us about the history of modern China and told us back in 1970 that in our lifetimes, China would matter perhaps more than any other country, and we need to understand it. And then when I joined the Foreign Office, I was tested for my ability to learn hard languages, as everyone was, and told I had a choice between Chinese, Japanese, and Arabic. But out of vanity and ambition, I chose Arabic because I thought that I could be ambassador in more countries. But ironically, precisely because I wasn't a sinologist, I was asked by Chris Patten, the last governor of Hong Kong, to be the head of the Hong Kong department in the run-up to the handover of Hong Kong. He didn't believe in what he called sinological claptrap, which was one of his mistakes, I think. Earlier in 1985, I'd visited China for the first time with the permanent undersecretary at the Foreign Office. We'd been to Shanghai to reopen the British Consulate General there, and then on to Beijing. So I've always been absolutely fascinated by China. And when nearly 10 years ago, I started to work for the HSBC, it was absolutely natural that I took an interest in China.
So it's worth mentioning that in addition to being CBBC's chair, you are also group head for public affairs at HSBC. And the next question I would like to ask involves how you have brought your experience as an ambassador into your new roles. As I mentioned in the introduction, you have served as ambassador three times previously to Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, and during times when it was imperative for a whole host of disparate reasons that the UK maintained positive relations, not only with your host country, but also important allies, chiefly the US. When you were ambassador to Israel, that was a period of heightened violence between Israel and Palestine, 2001 to 2003. When you were ambassador to Saudi Arabia, you were overseeing British policy towards a strategic linchpin for the UK's presence in the Middle East. And of course, when you were ambassador to Afghanistan, 2007 to 2009, you were overseeing the UK's involvement in the Afghan war. My question is, when working with your counterparts in those states, did you adopt a theoretical framework or a series of concepts underpinning those interactions? And if so, how do the fundamentals of conducting diplomacy in the Middle East differ to those required by today's China?
Well, the important thing, Joe, is always to pursue one's national interests, but one also needs always to seek common ground. I mean, any country will always have differences of one kind or another. So what you've got to do is identify those differences, set them on one side, do what you can to solve them, but maximize the mutual interest in working together on a win-win path. When I served in the British Embassy in Washington, we always had at least half a dozen major issues with the Americans at any one time, and that we didn't allow that to disrupt the overall relationship. And I hope very much that the British government can be mature enough to move to a relationship with China where we may have differences, but we are grown up enough to see that Britain's interest, China's interest, is in maintaining a load-bearing relationship, not covering just economics, not just covering investment or tourism or students, but also the great global issues, which both China and Britain, as permanent members of the Security Council, need to address, whether it's climate change or public health.
And moving our attention towards the role of business in that relationship that is becoming more complicated ever since the UK left the European Union, with trade having been repatriated as a competence to Whitehall. Over the last 2 years, the UK and China, we haven't had the traditional trade bilateral meetings that business usually uses to communicate its asks of the Chinese government to grow its business in the market. Now that business is having to do more communication with the Chinese government itself and take on a semi-diplomatic role in the relationship, what do you consider to be the three most important aspects to Chinese society, politics, culture, and its economy that a business must acknowledge when appraising their position in the China market, but also considering how their interactions with the Chinese government have gone?
Well, first and most important is, with China's vast and growing middle class, there's a huge appetite for British goods, whether they are Range Rovers or Peppa Pig, as our Prime Minister likes to say, or Scotch whisky or Burberry clothes, whatever it may be. So China is a vast consumer market, and it's a consumer market that's accessible now through the internet, through e-commerce. Second, and I think at least as important as the first, is that China is a source of innovation. Many of the technologies of the future are already deployed in China, whether it's high-speed rail, autonomous mobility, AI, battery technology. I saw this early on when I worked for HSBC on financial inclusion, and I saw the way in which, through digital delivery of financial services, through fintech, China was bringing financial services, not just cash loans, but also investment services, wealth management, to hundreds of millions of ordinary Chinese through their mobile devices. So the second point, Joe, is that the West has a very great deal to learn from China. And if we cut ourselves off, we cut ourselves off at our peril. And the third dimension is simply the human dimension. China is a great civilization. China has a lot to learn from the West, as Chinese academics acknowledge, but we too have a lot to learn from China. And I was reminded of only yesterday when I had a breakfast with a former group chairman of HSBC, Lord Green. And he said that in the past month, the thing that had given him most pleasure was to take part in a seminar with Renmin University on political philosophy. He'd read PPE, Politics, Philosophy and Economics at Oxford, and one of the professors at Renmin had read the same. And there was a debate with some of the students at Renmin University on political philosophy. And he said, there are few other countries in the world with whom one could have that kind of intellectual exchange.
I mean, the question of China's political philosophy is, well, firstly fascinating, but also one that has attracted far more scrutiny, not only in the West, but also in China over the last year in particular. So the next thing I'd like to ask you about Much has been made of the Chinese government's apparent determination to adopt a more Marxist, some have argued, autarkic lexicon through promoting ideas such as the dual circulation strategy, common prosperity, and a heightened focus on self-reliance. So is there still a role for foreign business in China? And how can British firms in particular marry their experience of doing business in the UK and third markets with these new unique demands of China?
Well, the only answer, Joe, is that China remains open to the world. Chinese leaders from President Xi Jinping down have stressed again and again that despite the emphasis on self-reliance, despite the emphasis on resilience, China must remain engaged with the world. And if you see the proportion of global trade that involves China, that's got to be true. So for Britain, particularly Britain post-Brexit, not engaging with China is not a sensible or sane option. We have to engage economically in terms of trade in goods and services, in terms of investment, and in terms of all the other flows that make a full broadband relationship between two great powers.
And turning our attention closer to home to how the UK is approaching that relationship, do you think that the UK government now has a well thought out economic strategy directing its engagement with China?
Well, a very good question, Jaya. I mean, I think the British Prime Minister is very clear that Britain needs to engage with China. He calls for a modern and mature relationship with China. He describes himself as a passionate Sinophile. Unfortunately, there are others in the Conservative Party. Many of them supported Brexit. Many of them are very close to certain right-wing circles in America who take a different view of China based in many cases on fear and ignorance. And so there isn't, regrettably, a coherent view across government. And some ministers who want to court popularity with the backbenchers spend their time either not mentioning China, or when they do mention China, doing so in through gritted teeth and in rather negative terms. So I think there's work to be done. The right approach to China was set out in the British government's integrated review of policy, of foreign policy and defence policy, which spoke of the need for a sensible multi-strand relationship with China, in which one protects one's national security, of course. Every country does that. One promotes one's values, of course one does that, but one engages where it's in the mutual interest to do so. And there's no question that that has to be the right approach.
So what do you consider to be the contribution of the business community to this debate? How can business leaders add value to the conversation happening in Westminster amongst parliamentarians who are trying to weigh up the pros and cons of the UK-China relationship in the round?
So what we've been doing as business is trying quietly to make the case for such a balanced relationship with China, in which we don't accentuate the negative, we seek common ground, and we have a policy that is overwhelmingly in Britain's interests. So there's work to be done. And because of the disagreements in government, in the Conservative Party, there is a role for business in making the case for the business relationship.
Sir Sherrod, I think that's a great place to bring things to a close. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Great. Well, it's a real pleasure to be with you, Joe. And thank you for all you do and all the CBBC team across China does to promote this relationship in our mutual interest.
Thank you. Well, we're going to keep this up. There'll be another episode of the China Business Brief coming out in 2 weeks' time. Sir Sherrod, thank you for coming on the podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye. China Business Brief is a podcast brought to you by the China Britain Business Council. If you enjoyed this podcast, make sure you're subscribed. To find out more about our other events and activities, do check out our website at www.cbbc.org.